I'll just give me a ring tomorrow. That'd be good. Okay.
Philosophy works midships and all.
Philosophy of Religion, lecture number 8. We discussed the ontological argument in the last lecture, and as I stated, on Mondays I think it's valid, on Tuesdays I don't think it is, and it's real tough to say. Even the first form, to a certain degree, I don't want to really get into it, we'll just confuse ourselves even more. But what I want to do now is get off the ontological argument and discuss the moral and teleological arguments. And it should be before it. There it is. Okay, the moral and the teleological. Let's put the teleological first, so we can go with that. We can live with that. Teleological argument, he's got listed on page 95, William Paley, Paley's Watchmaker. Again, the teleological argument argues that the design of the universe is evidence of an intelligent designer of the universe. William Paley, Archdeacon of Carlisle, and that from 1743, he lived from 1743 to 1805, and Paley's Watchmaker is what the argument's called, and he basically, I give a real simplified form in my notes. He just basically argues that even if you never saw a watch before in your life and you came upon it in the wilderness, you would know that it didn't just evolve into existence by chance. A watch, because of its design, implies a watchmaker. And the universe is one of design. You can find that from the fact of life on Earth, and some was a little closer, we'd all fry. Some was a little further away, we'd all freeze. Everything seems to be geared for life on Earth. They call that the anthropic principle of science today. Single-celled animal gives us evidence of that. They say there's enough genetic information. You can say it was enough to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. Now they say it's enough to fill an entire library. William Paley gave the illustration of the human eye, the complexities of the human eye and how well it was designed for the purpose of sight. So a watch, because of its design, implies a watchmaker, and since the universe is one of design, the universe therefore must be the product of an intelligent designer. And there's lots of illustrations that really give this watchmaker argument a lot of strength, I think. For instance, Charles Baxton, who said that for man to evolve by chance would be like a tornado going through a junkyard and producing randomly a Boeing 747. The illustration is often given that, you know, how many explosions would have to occur in a print shop before out would pop a Webster's dictionary. And of course, you can have an infinite number of explosions, you're never going to have to get a Webster's dictionary. It takes intelligence to design a dictionary. Now, that was William Paley's argumentation. Now, David Hume, that's on page 95 in your textbook by Geisler and Cordovan, under philosophy of religion textbook, on page 95, and it talks about David Hume's dialogues concerning natural religions. Well, there he's actually giving one of the characters in that. Hume used to write like a dialogue between guys with three different guys with Greek names, and he gives one of the arguments in it, but then he also one of his other characters later on tries to refute it. And what I'm looking here it is, page 98. Here's what I'm looking for. It's in that same book, after Clandes gives the argument, Philo, a skeptic, responds to it. And by the way, in his dialogues concerning natural religion, it's not real clear cut that Hume was totally against the teleological argument. In fact, it's implied at the very end of the text, the last paragraph in the text, it's implied that he thought that the arguments for the teleological argument were stronger than the arguments against it. Hume did not believe that we could even prove with certainty that the sun is going to rise tomorrow, yet he believed so much in the uniformity of nature that he believed miracles were impossible. So, or at least that we should never believe in miracles. So I think there's a dichotomy within David Hume's thought that we don't give as much attention to as we should. And one is, David Hume, the philosopher, would deny that we could prove the principle of causality, that every effect must have a cause. He'd say, well, we can't prove that with all certainty. But then in a personal letter to one of his friends, he could openly say, hey, I wasn't denying the principle of causality. I believe in it. I was just saying you couldn't prove it with certainty. And so I think we need to recognize that there may have been a dichotomy between Hume, the philosopher, and Hume, the living, breathing human being, who recognized there were certain things you couldn't prove with certainty. At the same time, there's a lot of things that we see with a high degree of probability. But he did seem to have much more respect for the teleological argument than he's given credit for, and that's probably because he devastated it to a certain degree, although the evidence shows that William Paley wrote his argument, his watchmaker argument, with full knowledge of Hume's arguments against it, and used Hume's arguments against it to help strengthen his own argument. In other words, he answered those objections in his argument. So it wasn't Hume that refuted Paley. It was Paley that used Hume to take the argument to a higher degree. Geiser states that the most famous critique of a teleological argument, is on page 98, comes from Hume. Although many scholars feel it is Hume's own view, he placed in the mouth of a skeptic, Philo, two responses to the teleological argument. The first is based on the assumption that there is design in nature, and argues that the God indicated by this design assumes that design would be at best, and then he lists several things. So the first response assumes design. It says, okay, I'll give you that. The skeptic says, okay, there is design in the universe. However, and that's how the first response is going to be. The second response, second argument, a little bit further down the page, the Philo does not assume that there is design in the world. It insists that it is possible that the world arose by chance. So it just basically is key premise there at the top on page 99, in an infinity of chance operations, every combination will be realized, and combinations that best fit will tend to perpetuate themselves once they happen. So it'll give the appearance of order, but it really isn't in order. I think we could argue against that very easily just by stating that just to attempt to communicate with another being, you're assuming a certain amount of order in the universe, a certain amount of intelligence in the universe, and a certain amount of design, enough design for you to formulate sentences that make sense. So I think that just refutes itself. But the first one is real interesting. To go back to page 98, even if there was design in the universe, design would be at best different from human intelligence, since human inventions differ from those of nature. Finite, number two, is a real key one here, a key attack on the teleologic argument. In other words, the God indicated by the design of the universe would be finite, since the effect is finite and the cause is like the effect. So what he's saying is, if you assume that the cause must be like the effect, you say, well, the effect has design, so the cause must be a designer. Well, let's carry that out. The effect is finite and limited, therefore the cause must be finite and limited too. So he's using the same premise, but he's using it in a way that Christians would not want to have. So now you got a limited God. Number three, he argues that the God, the intelligent designer, would be imperfect because there are imperfections in nature. He argues that God could be multiple. There could be many gods, but the creation of the world is more like the cooperative building of a ship than maybe, you know, the writing of a little letter, which could be done by one person. He argues also that God could be male and female, because this is the way that humans generate, and anthropomorphic, for his creatures have eyes, ears, noses, and other physical traits, therefore God probably would too. I don't think the first and the last are real, the first and the last two are really that devastating or that serious, but the key ones that have really hurt the teleological argument is that the teleological argument all by itself, if we find finite, limited design in the universe, why should we think that the cause of that finite, limited design is anything other than a finite, limited designer? And so basically you have a limited God. That's a strong hit on the teleological argument. Also the argument that, hey, this is a big universe, and maybe it took many gods to build. And now you have many gods, many finite, limited gods. And then evil and imperfections exist, so maybe you got an evil God. Those are strong arguments against the teleological argument. I agree with Geisler, they can be answered. The problem is, when you answer them, you really leave the realm of the teleological argument. You bring in cosmological premises, arguing from effect to the cause. In fact, even the teleological argument is really just an immoral argument as well. It just ties to cosmological argument. But basically, the way you would respond to those things is that finite, limited existence cannot explain or cannot sustain its own existence. And eventually you have to have infinite, unlimited existence to sustain the existence of everything else that exists. even the imperfections, all imperfections or evil is a perversion of that which is good. So ultimately good perfections will exist. Imperfections are just perversions of that which is perfect. You can't get evil unless you have good first. And as far as multiple, there could only be one infinite being, because two infinite beings would limit each other, and if they were limited, then they wouldn't be infinite. So there could only be one infinite being. Finite existence must be grounded in infinite existence. But these are all cosmological premises, and therefore you need more than just a teleological argument. You've got to go beyond the teleological argument. I agree with Geisler that the best way to use the teleological and the moral arguments for God's existence is to use them as later premises of the cosmological argument. In other words, first prove the existence of the uncaused cause, the one who sustains in existence all that exists, or everything else that exists, the one who caused the beginning of the existence of everything else as well. And then bring these premises in later and show, because there's morality in the universe, this uncaused cause must be a moral being. And because there's design, intelligent design in the universe, this uncaused cause must be an intelligent being. So in other words, you build the basis, you start your argument, the cosmological argument, and once you prove the existence of God, then the moral and teleological arguments can help you determine what kind of God this God is. Is he a pantheistic God, or is he the God of the Bible? Should have brought Aquinas to Summa Theologica, because he's got a real interesting argument that I don't even think. Aquinas argues a lot like A.E. Taylor's argument at the bottom of page 99, the apparent advanced planning within nature. Aquinas argues that natural things left to themselves do not reach pre-planned goals. An arrow doesn't find a bullseye unless you have a mind, a human being with a mind who aims the arrow at the bullseye and shoots for it. And when you have, what is it that turns into oak trees?
Acorns,
yeah. He says acorns only turn to oak trees and not something else, and so Aquinas argues there's got to be a mind behind the natural processes guiding nature in that proper direction, so that it would be. And the way he orders it is actually pretty strong. I think the only reason why it sounds weak to us, and it would even sound weak to Greeks that were entertaining the same type of spontaneous generation type thinking, is because we've heard it by so many quote unquote intellectuals, the evolutionary theory that things can go towards, that everything could evolve towards a proper goal, and things can work out in beneficial ways, totally on their own, without any mind, any thinking in the process whatsoever. If that was the case, it's kind of like what we're basically saying, but we've been programmed to think along those lines. But anybody who presents evolution in a way that really starts to sound plausible, after a while you start to realize that the evolutionary principle begins to take on more and more of the attributes of God. And evolution starts working towards a goal. And and that type of thing. But really, you know, if he, it's like the illustration that guys would give if he dropped confetti from an airplane and opened to spell your name when it reaches the ground, it's not going to do it. It's totally random. It's not going to do it. So then if you take the plane up higher, you say, well, if I get up higher, that'll give it more time. So that's all we need. Give it enough time, this confetti will form and spell my name when it hits the ground. But the more time you give it, the further up you go, the more spread out it is, the more random it is. And it seems that evolution, even if you give it billions and billions of years, it wouldn't make sense. So I think Aquinas was on to something. And I do think, though, Aquinas went through five different ways to argue for God's existence. If you put all five of them together, you come up with an explosive argument for God's existence, or if you put at least three or four of them together. And if you use that argument as later, some of the later premises, it takes up in strength. A.E. Taylor, more of a modern thinker, not in the way he thinks, but just more contemporary than Aquinas, obviously. On page 100, it says, nature reveals an anticipatory order, that is, it plans for its own preservation. Point number two. Nature's advanced planning cannot be accounted for by physical laws alone, for there are countless ways electrons could run, but they do move in accord with the advanced planning of preserving the organism. Point three, mind or intelligence is the only known condition that can remove these improbabilities against life emerging despite these improbabilities. Point four, the mind or intelligence that explains anticipatory adaptations cannot be explained as a result of evolution, for the advanced planning which gave rise to mind can only be explained as a result of mind. See, what this guy is, in point five, Darwinian natural selection cannot explain the advanced planning evident in nature, for Darwinism does not explain but merely presupposes life with a predatory environment. Therefore, if mind was not totally produced by nature, then it must have been active in the producing of nature, since nature indicates advanced planning explainable only by intelligence. What this guy says, this guy is not trying to refute evolution, by the way. What he's saying is, even if evolution is true, you still need a mind to direct the product. Yeah. So that's why when I argue against evolution, I argue that if evolution is true, it still needs God. But if God exists, he doesn't need evolution. But there's a lot of strong, good, solid things that we could use from the teleological argument. I just think that we'd be better off using it as closing premises of the cosmological argument, and just not using it on its own.
Well, it would stand on its own.
Yeah, because the thing is, too, is if you do try to make it stand on its own, what you end up doing is you end up smuggling so many cosmological premises in that it's
converted into a cosmological argument.
So, but I agree with Geisler on that point. William Lane Craig gives a modern rendition on page 104. Geisler quotes Craig giving a modern rendition of Paley's argument. He does it with living cells and specified complexity. Talks about living cells are characterized by the specified complexity. Crystals are specified but not complex. Random polymers are complex but not specified, but living cells are both specified and complex. And then he talks about a written language has specified complexity. A single word repeated over and over is specified, like a little kid saying dog, 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 pointing at the dog. A long series of random letters has complexity, like the alphabet, scramble it around, but a sentence has specified complexity. And so it takes the complex letters there, the complexity of all those letters, and it puts them into forms that make sense. So now you say, the dog wags its tail. So written language has specified complexity. Point number three, uniform experience informs us that only intelligence is capable of regularly producing specified complexity. Therefore, it is reasonable to assume that living organisms were produced by intelligence. Now, I think it's a very strong argument. At the same time, how will we know that intelligence is infinite? How will we know that intelligence is one being and not many beings? And how will we know that intelligence is a good intelligence and not evil intelligence? And we need cosmological premises.
Is this one a more formal teleological?
Yeah, because you look at the design, specified complexity of the same itself.
Carl Sagan ever, explained his odd dichotomy on that kind of issue?
No, but of course the dichotomy that John's talking about is he said that he believed that a single cell animal got here by chance, which could basically have enough genetic information to fill an entire library. Yet, at the same time, he said that if we receive a single message, which I presume to be a single sentence or a single paragraph, whatever you want to call it, a single message from outer space would prove intelligent life on other planets. So a single sentence or a single message proves intelligence when Sagan wants it to. But an entire library worth of information doesn't prove an intelligent cause if he doesn't want it to. And so there's definitely a tremendous dichotomy. Another big dichotomy in his thought is that he says that you can't be an intelligent man living in the 20th century and still believe that God exists. But then he has a policy, he will not debate creationists or Christian philosophers. So it says, if they're not intelligent, why not take them out to the woodshed in front of everybody and tear them off? So I think some of our people need to be held a little bit more accountable for what they say. Moral arguments for God's existence. There's lots of different ones. You can't believe that you could not prove God's existence by pure reason alone. But then Kant said that to make sense out of our moral experience, our moral experience makes no sense unless there's going to be life after death and rewards and punishments. And so Kant argued that to make sense out of moral life, we need to posit God's existence. And so he called that practical reason. So it wasn't so much an argument for God's existence as it was that a statement that we should assume that God exists, because there's no other way to make sense out of our moral lives. And that's one of the reasons why so many atheists end up denying absolute moral values. C.S. Lewis, I'm going to greatly simplify his argumentation here, and it's going to take some of its force away, but his moral argument, Lewis lived from 1898, died in 1963. His moral argument said that all admit to an objective moral standard. Now, what about people who deny absolute moral values? By the way, again, the moral argument you're arguing from the existence of an absolute moral law to the existence of, a, of an absolute moral lawgiver. But C.S. Lewis argued that all admit to an objective moral standard, even moral relativists. Even they admit to an objective moral standard, at least when they're wrong. When you do something, you, if you punch one of them for no reason, he's going to say that that action was wrong. Not just, well, you know, even a guy like A.J. Ayer, who says that to say murder is wrong is basically to say, I don't like murder, and I feel that murder is wrong. But he says, that's all you're really saying, is expressing your emotion. Well, that's not the case. If A.J. Ayer was still alive, and if you stole something from him, he would definitely feel that you had wronged him. And in a sense, he would appeal to a moral law that is above both you and him. And so C.S. Lewis would say that all admit to an objective moral standard, at least when we're wrong. And then C.S. Lewis would argue that nature is non-moral. You don't yell at a rock for tripping you. You don't expect a tree to get out of your way and that type of thing. You know, nature is non-moral. A tree isn't good or bad in the moral sense. And so all admit to an objective moral standard.
Nature is more Machiavellian than anything.
Yeah, especially when you turn to the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
The animal kingdom is like, you know, everybody thought of animal rights. So, you know, a lion does not think about animal rights when he's bringing down some kind of deer. All admits an objective moral standard. Nature is non-moral, therefore the objective moral standard must come from a supernatural cause. Okay? If it doesn't come from nature, it's got to come from something that transcends nature, hence the supernatural. He also had almost this identical argument from reason, that reason exists, because if we try to deny that reason exists, we have to try to reason when we make that denial. So reason exists, but nature is non-rational. Therefore, there must be, all reason comes from a thinking mind, therefore there must be a mind behind the reason that exists in the universe, and since it, reason doesn't come from nature, it must have a supernatural cause, and hence you come up with a supernatural mind. And to a certain degree, that's kind of right in between a cosmological and a teleological, but it is very similar to the premises of the moral argument that C.S. Lewis uses. Another way you could argue for a moral argument for God's existence would be that we all agree that there's a moral law out there. The big question comes up, what is it ultimately based on? The moral relativist says that it's the man. Each individual decides what is right and what is wrong. But the problem with that is then one individual can't call the actions of another individual wrong. I.e., you can't call the actions of Adolf Hitler wrong. So, some people have said, well, in that case, the moral law comes from society. It ultimately comes from society, the authority of a person's society. But the problem with that is then one society can't call the actions of another society wrong. I.e., America can't call Nazi Germany wrong for the people it's killed. So then other people would say, well, then I guess it would be answered by a world consensus. Whatever the world consensus is, that is what is right. Now that's a pretty horrible world to live in, because you go back 150 years ago and world consensus was that slavery was just part of life and there's nothing wrong with it. And that also means that 150 years from now, slavery might not be wrong again. World consensus was wrong when it thought the world was flat. And most people believe world consensus was wrong when they said that slavery was all right. So I think even the world consensus, I think what is happening here is that we keep quantitatively adding more and more men and women into the picture and think we are getting qualitatively higher moral law. And we're not. What we're doing is quantitatively adding moral legislators.
Well, now,
what we need is a moral law that is qualitatively above man in order for us to even judge the world at a particular time and say that slavery was wrong. The world was wrong at that time. And so what we basically need, if we need a moral law that's qualitatively above man, we need a God, a moral lawgiver who is qualitatively above man as well. Yeah, Josh?
No.
Okay, and again, too, when we're dealing with any, I should have started this from the start, but the ontological argument argues a priori before experience, okay? All the other arguments that we're talking about do not argue from reason alone, but they argue a posteriori. They argue, they start with the real world and then try to argue back to God. They start with finite things and then try to argue to the infinite.
Yeah, exactly.
The a priori, the ontological, if it worked, it's deductive. It proves its conclusion with certainty, such as 1 + 1 = 2. But, and depending on whether or not you like it, is whether or not the ontological argument made it. But the moral and teleological and even cosmological argument, you're dealing with probability. When you have inductive arguments, remember, deductive, you start with the general or the universal, and then you argue to the particular. With the cosmological, teleological, and moral argument, you argue inductively from the part to the whole. And so you're arguing from the finite thing, so you're basically going to only come up with a probable conclusion. Now you can come up with a very high degree of probability, such as Geisler's leads you to prove God's existence with actual undeniability. It's actually undeniable that he exists, not rationally inescapable, not rationally necessary, not logically necessary, but it's actually undeniable, which is about as close as you can get to logical necessity without being there. But it's still only a very high degree of probability. Some would say that you can prove God's existence beyond all reasonable doubt. We hang men when we're beyond all reasonable doubt. Charles Hodge talks about that, you know, using premises that the denial of these premises would be forced and temporary. That you could deny the existence of morality, deny God's existence, and deny the existence of love, but then you go and tell your wife you love her, and you go and you eat food, even though you don't really believe, you claim that you don't believe in your existence. The denial of those is forced and temporary, and so they'd be what people like Aquinas would call self-evident principles, self-evident truths. Aquinas argued that the first principles of knowledge, you can't reason in an infinite regress, because then you never prove anything if you keep looking for reasons for everything. So there has to be first principles of knowledge, and Aquinas argued that the first principles of knowledge, you can't prove them. At the same time, you have to assume them even if you try to deny them. And so you can get a very high degree of probability, especially with the cosmological argument for God's existence. At the same time, we're not dealing with certainty. So even our moral argument is not going to be as strong as we would like it to be, or the teleological, but I think when you put the teleological and the moral as the finishing touches on the cosmological argument, you can have a very extremely high degree of probability that God exists. And you cannot prove your own existence with logical necessity. But only a jackass would deny his own existence. I think it gets to the point, like, I cannot prove false the view that everything, the whole world doesn't really exist. I'm just having a dream and someday I'm going to wake up. Because I've had dreams where I thought people were trying to murder me and I woke up in a cold sweat realizing it was only a dream. Well, maybe I'm going to wake up from a 35 year long dream and find out that, going to find out that I'm the only one that really exists. Well, I cannot disprove that with certainty. But only a fool would really believe that that's what life's all about. And like Francis Schaeffer in his argument, that you can sum up Schaeffer's argumentation in one sentence, and that is that all non-Christian thought cannot be lived out in a consistent fashion. Everybody lives like Christianity is true, whether or not they're Christians. And the pantheists that believe some absurd thing, or claim to believe, but like Charles Hodges said, they're forced and temporary. And the pantheist, you know, he's trying to tell you that we don't have separate existence, we're all one being. Yet he is pleading with you to try to convince you that you do not exist separately from him. But he's assuming your separate existence as he pleads with you to try to disprove your separate existence. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense there. So Schaeffer would argue that the non-Christian positions and worldviews cannot be lived consistently, and only a Christian can live consistent with his worldviews. We looked at the ontological argument for God's existence. We looked at the moral and the teleological. Geisler's view is the ontological argument doesn't hold any water. Aquinas would agree with him on that. I would say I could go either way on it. It's a real tough one to call, but it's not real, real popular, and it's not real, real persuasive with most people. So the moral and teleological, if you start out with cosmological premises, they can do a fantastic job putting the finishing touches on the cosmological argument. So that's the way we're going to use those. We'll come back to them. And the next two lectures, what we're going to do, we're going to spend on the cosmological argument. And we're going to discuss a few different cosmological arguments. Maybe I'll bring the Summa Theologica and an abridged version of it. And we'll read some of Aquinas' arguments for God's existence. And we'll talk about Francis Schaeffer and his contribution, and Geisler, and William Lane Craig, and J.P. Moreland, and some of the stuff that's going on, the three different types of cosmological arguments. And then we'll bring the moral and teleological back into the picture for the final premises and try to argue that it's beyond reasonable doubt that the God of the Bible does exist, as Geisler would say, it's actually undeniable that God exists. He's not saying that a guy can't deny it, but he's saying that someone can't deny it without actually contradicting himself in the denial. And so we'll look at some of that argumentation in the next two lectures as we deal with the cosmological argument.
I'm reading a fascinating book right now called The Big Bang Never Happened.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's Richard Lerner, Peter Lerner, something like that. And although I agree with him, the Big Bang Never Happened, his follow-on, the title of the teaser to get you to get this book so he can prove to you his theory of an infinite universe. Yeah. An eternal, infinite plasma universe that existed, eternal past, eternal future, and is progressing and evolving and changing. It
I it sounds like the book that that guy with the question mark and the duff and the t-shirt was talking about.
Yeah. Will you write that book? I'll say it.